Good morning, and welcome to Ask Dr. Dawn. This hour of debate, dialogue, healthcare, and science in the news is all for you, and I hope that you'll enjoy it and continue to listen and maybe even call in. But before I do that, I need to remind you that the opinions expressed on this program represent those of the speakers and not necessarily those of the station, its staff, or its contributors. Furthermore, the purpose of this program is education and entertainment. It's not intended as a substitute for a professional consultation. Well, there's a great big debate that has been going on, and let's call it acid versus alkaline diets. I mean, I'm sure that many of you have heard the stories, and the concept is pretty much as follows. When you eat protein, you're consuming acid in the form of amino acids. Well, you have to get rid of that acid, and you do so by buffering it with calcium, and the calcium comes from your bones. So the concern is that a high protein diet might over time contribute to osteopenia and osteoporosis. And this is almost a point of received wisdom, particularly in the alternative medicine world, that you want to have an alkaline diet because it's healthier and because too much protein, well, it causes osteoporosis. And this is all very logical. It just turns out that it's probably not true. And I was very surprised to come across this article. This was published about 15 years ago in the Journal of Bone and Mineral Research, and it was actually a offshoot of the Framingham study, which was begun many years ago and has continued for over 50 years now, where they started out looking at heart disease, and they studied cholesterol, and they studied all sorts of factors, tracked people prospectively. So you start in 1950 and you enroll a bunch of people in a town, you get diet histories, you examine them, you send them questionnaires in 10, 15, 20, 30, 50 years. You get a lot of information and you can find out all kinds of things. So the researchers went back and they massaged this data looking at bone and protein intake, and as people aged, and they had about 700 participants, a mean age of 75 years, and people who had the protein intake dietarily of the lowest quartile had the greatest bone loss and the most osteoporosis, and those who had the highest protein quartile actually had the best bone density. And that's counterintuitive. And it's good. It's a good lesson for us all, because even though something might make physiologic sense, as the alkaline hypothesis does, if it doesn't actually play out in real life, and it takes years, of course, 20, 30, 50 years to figure this out, then some other factor, which we've not identified about a high protein diet, or something that goes along with a high-protein diet, is protective or even beneficial to bones. So it's just one of those things that we have to be careful of, and it's always just going to be exactly that. You can have a hypothesis, it can make physiological sense, but unless it turns out to be true, it's just an interesting thought problem. And here's another interesting thought problem for you, and this one about the use of antibiotics and type 2 diabetes. First of all, I want to contrast the Framingham study, which was, of course, funded research where they chose people in a town and sent them questionnaires, and this study done in Denmark, where they had registries. They have the National Registry of Patients, the Prescription Registry, the Danish Person Registry. So essentially, they have data on everybody. And it's the same data collected in the same way. So it's much higher quality than just sending people out a questionnaire and dealing with the fact that, well, some of the people won't answer it. This data is generated passively and collected on everyone. So it makes for a really interesting study. And what the researchers did was they looked at the idea that we know that antibiotics are associated with obesity. In fact, antibiotics are given to food animals, right, in their feed, because they weigh more if you give them antibiotics. We now understand that this is probably related to the microbiome and that the antibiotics kill off certain bacteria, which in the long run are the bacteria that keep us thin and potentially more fit. Whereas if you kill them off with antibiotics, you get a change in the microbiome, which contributes to obesity. The researchers asked the question, is there data to support the idea that antibiotic use might increase one's risk of getting type 2 diabetes? And if so, what's the odds ratio or the increase in that risk? And they found some very interesting data. It was 1.5 times more likely to develop diabetes in this large population cohort if you had had more than 5 antibiotics in the last 15 years. And they used, had you filled the prescriptions for antibiotics more than 5 times or more in the last 15 years. And if you had, you had higher rates of diabetes. And they thought it through, so they excluded prescriptions for the last year prior to diagnosis of diabetes, because they thought, quite rightly, that an infection might uncover diabetes and let it to be diagnosed, and also the fact that a person might already be a little immune suppressed from their diabetes and thus more likely to get infection. And they were trying to establish a suspicion, or at least a credible causal link, in that the antibiotics precede the diabetes versus the other way around. So it was a pretty well-designed study. And the suggestion is that certain antibiotics had worse profiles than others. And there's a graph in this published study, which is available online, and I will post it for your interest in the resources page at AskDrDawn.com. But around page 5 of this, there is an amazing graph showing that people who had had more than 20 antibiotics over the 15 years prior to diagnosis had double the risk of developing diabetes. So this is interesting, and it raises the issue in my mind of what are we going to do when we give antibiotics as an ethical physician who's trying to do no harm and confronted with an infection that I feel requires antibiotic treatment. How am I going to ameliorate the damage that I may be doing with this therapeutic agent? How can I make it gentler? What probiotics should I give? Can I replace the bacteria or influence the situation such that I rehabilitate the gut and the person doesn't end up with a permanent imprint? Now, at a conference I attended about 6 months ago, I learned to my great surprise that the antibiotic clindamycin is particularly profound in terms of its effect on the microbiome. And in fact, there is a profile, kind of a fingerprint, in the microbiome analysis. If you look at the genetics and identify what organisms are in a person's gut, you can tell by the profile whether or not this person has ever taken clindamycin. It leaves a permanent fingerprint in the microbiome. How important is that? Is there an increase in the risk of diabetes? And oddly enough, this paper did look at that, and the increase in diabetes from clindamycin specifically is really, the odds ratio was really one or less. So in other words, even though clindamycin makes a big impact on the microbiome that we can see in our analysis, whatever that impact may be, it doesn't increase the risk of diabetes. So these two studies, done far apart and with completely different materials and technologies, just deepen the mystery of what is going on in there. And we are just children in the forest. We do not know what we're doing. Thanks to Judith in Atlanta for bringing the diabetes and antibiotic study to my attention. And that brings us to our next story, which is about beta-glucan. Beta-glucan is a carbohydrate that we cannot digest ourselves. We can't use it. So it feeds our commensal bacteria, our probiotics, and it encourages the growth of the probiotics that we would like to see, like beneficial lactobacilli. Beta-glucans are found in fungi, in the cell walls of certain bacteria, and also in oats and barley. And they've been used to boost the immune system. They're clinically shown to improve T-cell function and thus boost immunity. And certain of the beta-glucans in mushrooms have been shown to improve cancer survival in lab animals. So pretty exciting stuff here. These researchers used a pasta that had been enriched with an extra dose of 3 grams of barley beta-glucans. And 3 grams, that's 3,000 milligrams, folks. So it would fit into about half of a teaspoon, if you were to think of it in terms of volume. And they found that just after 2 months, they had shifted the gut flora in a positive direction, higher levels of lactobacilli, lower levels of Enterobacteriaceae. These are some of the, among other non-beneficial bacteria that were in the GI tracts initially. And they saw an increase in short chain fatty acids, which are bacterial metabolites like butyric acid and propionic acids. These are anti-inflammatory. And we know, and they also noted a drop in the cholesterol of these individuals from, these were healthy test subjects, youngins probably, but the LDL was 107 initially and dropped to 93.8 on the average in the test subjects just by eating 100 grams of pasta with 3 grams of these barley beta glucans in them. So this is really interesting stuff and a small intervention with potentially some really strong benefit. I think I'm going to have to figure out how to eat some barley. So I'm going to jump to an email. Chris in Modesto asked about magnesium threonate. Hi, Dr. Dawn. While researching absorbable forms of magnesium, I came across articles that mentioned a newly engineered magnesium developed by researchers at MIT. I read an article on magnesium threonate by David Perlmutter, someone I heard you mention on the show. Love to hear your thoughts about this supplement and how it might be different from other absorbable forms of magnesium. And yes, this was a really interesting topic, and I went and searched on it. Thanks for bringing it up. And I have heard the statements about the magnesium threonate being a beneficial compound, helping with memory and cognition. So I went searching in Google Scholar and found lots of articles that did establish in rats that you have increased magnesium in the brain when you give magnesium threonate, and that you can essentially cross the blood-brain barrier and force more magnesium into the brain. So that's established. And the researchers were mainly looking in rats at memory functioning and pain. And what they found was that overall, rats' memories performed better. Their cognition was improved by the addition of extra magnesium against control rats. And also particularly where there was pain interfering with cognition, and that seemed to be a thread that was followed quite deeply, you would get less generalization, normalization of behavior, and effectively the rats were better able to ignore the pain and perform the cognitive tasks and be, just more functional. This opens up all kinds of implications. I was, however, not able to find any studies on my admittedly brief search yesterday about humans. And of course, Dr. Perlmutter is kind of at the advanced end of things, and he does absolutely have ties to the nutraceutical industry. So you have to kind of view some of what he says as having a bit of an infomercial quality. I think his science is impeccable, but he may be cherry picking the data a little bit. I don't know I have a lot of respect for him, and I do think that he's extremely enthusiastic about the things he writes about, and perhaps a little bit, of that could be self-interest. You know, you take your information where you can find it. Overall, I am very intrigued with this. I wish it were cheaper. I wish it were better validated in humans. But if someone is going to buy this stuff, I would suggest doing some baseline cognitive testing and then getting an average, maybe test yourself 4 or 5 times. There's a very good cognitive test that's free online at foodforthebrain.org. And you can take this test, shoot them a small donation, please. It is a charitable institution. But then you can, they'll save your data. You can take the test 4, 5, 6 times, make the average score, do your intervention with the magnesium 3 and 8. In the rats, they were using very, very high doses, 50 milligrams per kilogram per day of elemental magnesium, which works out to 600 milligrams per kilogram per day of the magnesium 3 and 8. If you realize what your weight is in kilograms, we're talking about very, very large doses in the rats. I'm sure the doses that are being marketed to humans are substantially less than 600 milligrams per kilogram. So at that point, is the dose sufficient? That's where the cognitive testing that you do yourself comes in. After several weeks or a month, plenty of time, according to the rat studies, retest yourself and see whether or not you detect cognitive improvement. The reason I like that particular cognitive test that I told you about is because it was designed not to improve with practice, and they did test that and establish that the practice effect is not significant there. So you can do an intervention and retest yourself and then stop the stuff, go another couple of months or maybe a month, and repeat the test and see if your scores revert back to the old level. If so, it works for you at the dose you were taking, and you get to decide whether or not that's a cost-effective intervention, and that's going to depend on your income and your personal circumstances. And my producer just flashed me an article that appeared in Neuron. I will go ahead and review that myself and post it up on the resources section at AskDrDawn.com if I feel that it is worth throwing out at you. Magnesium is great stuff, and the idea that we can do things like inhibit tumor necrosis factor alpha, which is really powerful, and that's that's one of the characteristics that these Chinese researchers found in their rat work looking at magnesium 3 and 8. So thanks again to Chris for bringing that one to my attention. We're going now to Joel in Santa Cruz. Hello, Joel. Welcome to the program.
Thank you for taking my call.
My pleasure.
I spend a lot of time in the sun and the wind, and despite covering my lower lip continuously, I have a perpetual blister or cold sore, and I'm just curious what you think about that.
Is it always in the same spot?
Well, it usually is. It's actually moved just recently. The last few years, it was always in the same spot, but it just moved over a little bit the last couple months.
One of the problems with a sore like this is whether or not you've actually got something that's turning into a skin cancer. And they can be kind of hard to differentiate. So if it's looking like a classic herpes where it's totally normal skin, it bubbles up, it crusts scabs, the scab breaks off a few times, bleeds, and then it heals up completely and is back to normal skin for at least a couple of weeks before it happens again, then I wouldn't worry about cancer. But if it doesn't meet all of those criteria, I have to say that maybe getting the area biopsied would be a good idea. Now, leaving that aside, what have you tried for prevention? Have you tried using sunscreen on the area?
I have.
Okay, and that's been unsuccessful. Have you tried using lysine, which is an amino acid that is, in some people at least, able to discourage or somehow inhibit the development or outbreaks of herpes? Have you tried that?
No.
Okay, so that might be the first place to try. Doses of lysine, you're probably wanting to take maybe 3 to 5,000 milligrams, so a half a teaspoon to a teaspoon of the powder. And I don't know if the powder is bitter. You may need to get this in capsules. Usually people take it in capsules. So that would be the natural remedy to go to. And if that isn't successful, you could consider doing like a year of suppressive treatment with valacyclovir or acyclovir. What I have found clinically, and I believe that there is some research that backs this up, but clinically it's pretty solid, is that if you suppress the outbreaks for a while, months to years, when you stop with the suppressive agent, the tendency to break out has lessened. And it may just have to do with the number of copies of the herpes virus in your nerve cells. But that's my hypothesis anyway. But regardless of the mechanism, it is true that you can see improvement in the frequency of outbreaks, both with oral and genital herpes. There is vitamin C. And I have seen if you take a big dose of vitamin C immediately after windburn or sunburn, vitamin C plus ibuprofen together seem to have a sort of magic ability to reduce the chances of a herpes outbreak. But I have not seen data on that. That's purely anecdotal. Patient told me about it. I've tried it myself on a few occasions, but since I don't invariably get a reaction when I go skiing or when I get sunburned, it's not very scientific.
What about like a vitamin A oil that they have for your lips?
Oh, I imagine it's a good emollient. Vitamin A is relatively good antioxidant. It helps with skin healing. Might be helpful, but I've never heard or seen anything about it.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you very much.
You're very welcome. Have a great day.
You too. Bye-bye.
Going now to Anonymous in Gilroy. Dear Dr. Dawn, for some years now, 5 to 7, I get cold sores when I eat nuts, peanuts, walnuts, hazelnuts, just cold sores, which are bad enough, not swelling, itching, or anaphylaxis. So I can eat stuff made on equipment that processes nuts. Am I allergic to nuts? Fortunately, I can eat almonds, but that gets boring sometimes. This comes at a time when I'm trying to eat a healthier diet with less animal meat, more nuts, also because I was diagnosed with rheumatoid arthritis 3 years ago. Do I go to an allergist to get tested? Is there hope that I can enjoy a variety of nuts again? Well, Anonymous, first of all, let's delve down a little bit into this word allergy. Oh, because you have rheumatoid arthritis. This is an autoimmune disease, and one of the manifestations of this is an upregulated immune system where you are kind of on the war path and the immune system is actually attacking the joints. So there is a lot of additional inflammatory activity, a lot of chemicals circulating in the bloodstream which are pro-inflammatory. It's sort of like the smell of smoke, if you will. If there's a fire in on the hillside, the smell of smoke is in the bloodstream, and the immune system has smoke detectors. And when it smells smoke, it goes looking for the source. And this leads to, a feedback loop. Now, on top of that, we bring in the type part of the immune system that we call the allergic system. There are hypersensitivity. It's probably a better word, right? Because you're more than normally reactive to something. Now, there are three different immunoglobulins involved with hypersensitivity. There's IgE, which is the one that we think of as classic allergy. That's the one where you get hives and wheezing and the throat swelling up. And in the case of massive amounts of histamine being triggered as a result of the IgE cross-linking the mast cells, which are little bags of histamine wandering around in your system, you can go into shock and even die as a result of this. And this is the classic bee sting allergy. This is the child who can't be in a room where another child is eating peanut butter. This kind of allergy is deadly, and this is the focus of allergists and allergy testing. They're really looking for that kind of a reaction. But there are two others. There's IgG, which is, well, that's the circulating immunoglobulin that gloms onto bacteria, and this is when, or and viruses. And so when we vaccinate you, we are trying to create cells called plasma cells that will actually release IgG into the circulation, so that if you get tetanus, being a tetanus toxoid being produced by Clostridia tetani that's at the base of a puncture wound, your immunoglobulins will glom onto that toxoid and inactivate it so that the toxin doesn't cause you to develop tetanus and die. So that's the basis of that kind of immunization. And IgG is also very common in food sensitivities and may be part of what's going on in your case. Often the symptoms with IgG are distant. So you might get gut symptoms, but you might get eczema or rosacea or joint pain or just feel really tired. These are why food sensitivities are really hard to nail down. And sometimes people will have high levels of IgG to a substance but appear not to react at all, or at least not clinically or discernibly. So it's confusing, and this is alternative land. This is not recognized medically as an issue, but of course it is. Now, IgA is the immunoglobulin that's made by your saliva glands, by the inside of your mouth, and by your tongue and lips. So this is the one that I'm suspecting, in your case, might be upregulated, and we don't really test for IgA, or so going to an allergist would not probably do you much good. What we would say, what I would say, is that if you are reacting to a series of different nuts, you really should stop eating them for a period of time. And I would say pretty exclusively, maybe for a year, and then try small challenges and see if you can tolerate them then. It may be that you can tolerate small amounts if you vary what they are and you don't eat them every day. And there are many other good sources of protein. And coconuts, by the way, healthy fat, and do not cross-react with tree nuts. So that's a place that you might want to look into for your protein. But ultimately, the most important thing here is that what we eat does influence our bodies in unpredictable and convoluted and complex ways. And so observation, cutting back on something, doing a very careful re-challenge down the line is the best advice I can give you for this kind of a problem. Time for some science. We have been playing around with drug delivery and enhanced drug delivery for some time in materials technology, but researchers at the University of San Diego recently pulled something really brilliant out of their hat that I'm happy to be able to tell you about. The researchers took platelets out of people's circulation and centrifuged them and then put them through a kind of vibrating device that broke the platelets up, and then they separated off the membranes, the broken, well, basically the eggshell fragments, if you will, of the platelets, and then used these to coat nanoparticles that were made of a biodegradable polymer that were packed with drug molecules. And these drug molecules are sort of loosely held in the polymer, so they diffuse through the platelet membrane. And the platelet membrane that was on these nanoparticles still had its receptors intact. So platelets have really useful characteristics in that they home in on blood vessel breakage. So they honed in on blood vessel tears. And they also hone in on MRSA bacteria. So you can essentially target an antibiotic and send it directly to the bacteria that you're trying to kill. So you can use much lower doses, which is awesome, because vancomycin, which is the main antibiotic that we use for MRSA, is very toxic, potentially, to the kidneys. And it's a dose-related toxicity. So if we could use a sixth of the dose, and that's what these researchers did, they put a sixth the amount of the usual dose of vancomycin into nanoparticles, wrapped them in platelets, and put them into the bloodstream of animals that had been infected with MRSA. And then they gave some other animals the same amount of MRSA infection, and then gave them a full clinical dose of vancomycin. So they compared head-to-head. They were, I think, hoping to see that the platelets worked as well as the therapeutic dose of vancomycin. Instead, the 1/6 dose in these nanoparticles was actually 1,000 times more effective in lowering the amount of bacteria in the infected organs. This is a phenomenal improvement. You could reduce the dose by 85%, and you could thus protect the kidneys, and you got 1,000 times more effective elimination of the bacteria, meaning you could probably reduce the dose a lot more and still get this targeted benefit. So this is a relatively simple type of drug delivery system. And the fact that platelets are, in general, transfusible and do not, you don't get platelet reactions like you do from being transfused with the wrong kind of blood, means that this could be mass produced. And this may be a real breakthrough in how we treat, particularly disseminated and advanced MRSA, which is a horrible disease, especially since you can be left, as I said, with kidney damage from the drug itself. Great, cool stuff coming up. And let's go to one more story before we go back to some callers. This is a little bit about bracing and scaffolding for nerves. Researchers have in the University of Minnesota have actually succeeded in regenerating the sciatic nerve in lab animals after sectioning. And basically animals whose nerves were cut and who were paralyzed have a 3D printed sciatic nerve, well, basically kind of a tube shaped like the nerve, implanted on either side of the cut edges. And then the nerve was rapidly able to regenerate along the scaffolding. One of the problems with nerves when you cut them is that the nerve will die back to the nucleus. It's called Wallerian degeneration. And a new nerve axon will sprout and try to grow back along the nerve sheath, but the nerve sheath degenerates as well. So if we can build a 3D nerve that's hollow and put it right up to the edge of a damaged nerve, maybe even cut that nerve back a little bit to the way you would if you were doing a transplant or a plant graft, cut it back a bit, tuck it into this 3D printed tube, and inside the tube, besides being a biodegradable polymer, they've implanted nerve growth factor. And so the nerve growth factor signals the growth, speeds it up, and in fact, they're getting these rats back to from totally paralyzed to walking in 3 months. I want to see this move to human studies ASAP. I think this could be the game changer. Maybe we don't even need to be playing around with stem cells if we can use the growth factor and get that graft and scaffolding in there. Too cool. And let's go now to Mardine in Ben Lomond. Hello, Mardine.
Hello, good morning. Thank you for taking my call.
My pleasure.
The last time I called, which was just a few weeks ago, you suggested that I might stop taking blood thinners, and including aspirin. And I was wondering if other pain relievers are also in blood thinners like ibuprofen and acetaminophen.
Okay, good question. Acetaminophen does not have any effect on platelets or clotting factors. Ibuprofen and naproxen, all of the non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs will actually have an effect on blood clotting. And clinically, if the ibuprofen is freshly delivered into the bloodstream, you get blood thinning. And then it's kind of a two-phase thing. Towards the very end, as the drug wears off, you actually have a relative pro-coagulant tendency that happens briefly. So it's sort of like thins your blood, and then you get a rebound thickening, and then you're back to normal. Hmm. And that, if you're taking the ibuprofen continuously for pain, for example, you're probably not going to have too much of that pro-coagulant effect, and you'll mainly be anticoagulated. That turns out to be enough of a pro-coagulant effect that you do get a statistical bump in heart disease and stroke in susceptible individuals. So if you're high risk, maybe you shouldn't be using ibuprofen and should be using naproxen sodium, which has the least procoagulant effect of all of them.
Okay.
What was the context, if you'd remind me, of the reason I suggested you stop taking those? Were you going to be getting surgery or something?
No, I've been having little pools of blood forming under my skin.
Oh, okay, yeah. So, right. So, has it helped?
Yes, I haven't had anything happen in, you know, the last 2 weeks. I haven't seen anything like that, but it was kind of sporadic anyway.
Yeah, so it's hard
it's
to say
hard
for
to
sure.
Say, yeah.
Yeah. But I think, you know, use acetaminophen if you don't have any liver issues. Never mix acetaminophen and booze. That's mm-hmm. like total bozo no-no. But you can do this. Acetaminophen, if that isn't working, then and you need something for pain control, I would go to the naproxen, which is over the counter as Aleve, and you'd want to take a high dose, so maybe 2 Aleve twice a day. And as always, non-steroidal anti-inflammatories, they can all give you GI bleeding, so take them with food and be alert for black poop, because if you see black sticky poo, you probably are bleeding in your stomach and you need to stop the non-steroidals and go see a doctor.
And you had said something to other callers in the past about not taking it right before you go to bed.
Right, for the same reason, because your stomach's empty and your stomach and digestion in general is very, very sluggish at night. So you're going to take something that is an irritant, and it's going to sit there against the back of your stomach wall and kind of fizz all night and irritate that lining. And so I always feel that that's not a very prudent thing to do. Some people have the cast iron stomach and can get away with it, but statistically, 40,000 people a year in the United States don't get away with it and end up in the hospital getting transfused for a GI bleed.
Mm, wow. Okay, so with dinner before you, you know, a couple hours before you go to bed is the safest time.
Yeah, pretty much.
Okay. And are there any other alternative pain treatments? I've heard people mention cherry bark, I think.
Well, it depends on, it's actually sour cherry juice.
Okay.
And arthritis pain, I've had a lot of anecdotal reports that works. I've had people call in on the program and kind of testify, and then people call in 2 weeks later who heard that program and said, you know, I tried it and it actually does work. So it's anecdotal, but it's a food. So what have you got to lose?
Yeah, you can get it at healthcare.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. So you could try that. I personally am a big fan of fish oil and curcumin taken together, and of course, with your bruising issue, you might want to just stick with the curcumin alone, and you need to get curcumin that's been an extract of turmeric and take 250 to 500 milligrams of that, or you need to take about a teaspoon of turmeric and about a eighth a little bit under an eighth of a teaspoon of black pepper together once a day, and that kind of equilibrates out and absorbs as curcumin. And so it's a lot of turmeric, though. So if you're, you know, if you come from South India, that's probably no problem. But if you're used to the standard American palate, that's going to taste a bit weird. So a lot of my lower income patients will actually sit there and fill capsules with that mixture. Mm-hmm. And you figure out it's usually about six capsules, the 00 capsules to equal an adequate dose to get benefit. So you could give that a try. There's also an herb called uña de gato or cat's claw, which is a really strong anti-inflammatory. Boswellia is pretty good as well. So those are things that are health food store items that you might also give a shot and see what you get.
And do they have any effect on blood thinning?
No, none of them do.
Okay. Wonderful. Thank you very much.
Please call back. Let me know how it comes out for you, Mardine.
All right, I will.
All right, bye-bye. We're going now to Clyde in Corralitos. Hello, Clyde.
Hi, Dr. Don. Thank you for taking my call. Okay. My 17-year-old sons, twin sons, have been recommended to take Accutane by their dermatologist. And I see things like suicide and so on and so forth, all these terrible side effects.
Yes, and
what's
so...
What's the story?
Well, teenagers are emotionally labile. And suicide among teenagers is a substantial issue. So that's the first thing that I want to say. It's a group that if you destabilize them in some way, you're going to see a bump in suicide. That's why the antidepressants have this high suicide association in teenagers. It's because they are prone in that direction in the first place. So I don't think that Accutane and Paxil probably are any different in terms of the fact that they both do this. And yes, the statistics are pretty clear that you do, but these are people who would probably already have been somewhat predisposed, labile, and this is the SWAT, or the straw that breaks the camel's back, so to speak. So you'll get these statistical blips. What does it mean? I think that this drug is seriously overused, and it needs to be reserved for situations where the person's looking at lifelong disfigurement from scarring from deep cystic acne. And a lot of times now it's being used at a much lower threshold. It's being used to give you clear skin when you have, a few, superficial pimples that are not the kind that are the deep rocks that don't come to a head, but just sort of sit there and bulge out of your face for months at a time. That's cystic acne, and that needs to be treated because disfigurement is on the table here, and that's no fun. But I don't know how bad your son's acne is, and you should tell me that.
Well, it doesn't seem that bad to me. Yes, they do have, and if they don't take their other lesser medications, it certainly flares up. And the one son has it on his back now. So.
And what other therapies have been tried?
Well, I know they're taking antibiotics. That's what I know. I don't really know which antibiotics they're taking.
Well, they do have high levels of testosterone right now. Part of the life cycle, and so that testosterone makes their cells clump together so that when they exfoliate, they tend to block their own pores,
right.
And they'll outgrow that. And of course, the sebum production is very high, so keeping the bacteria count down is a good thing to do. Probiotics, oddly enough, I'm always talking about probiotics, but there are studies that show that improves the skin. Changing the diet and particularly moving away from saturated fats and an inflammatory diet, which is to say lots of starch and sugar, also does show benefit. If you clean up the diet, you can often clean up the skin. And of course, you know, teenagers are free-range individuals, so they have to be committed to the dietary changes. Nothing that can be imposed on them. In general, I think if you will not, people don't go from being, you know, a happy, totally well-adjusted person who's social and engaged to, you know, blowing their head off that night. So there's going to be warning signs if the person's developing depression. And I think the fact is you've got to watch for that in any kid, no matter what they're taking.
One other thing that I've read online about the Accutane seems to be that some people say that it works okay for a while and then the stuff, the acne comes back.
Well, I think that that's true. If you haven't, you've got an underlying source. But people who stay on it, you know, I've had many patients who were on it and it did clear up their skin for as long as they took it. But as soon as they stopped taking it, they got rebound symptoms. And I don't know if it was any worse than it would have been if they'd never taken the drug. I didn't see that. But it could be. It could be that there's a rebound effect. Certainly the body, when you push against the body pushes back.
Right. Well, we're just in a quandary here and don't really know what to do. The doctor's saying yes, and
says
no.
You know, what I would do is, I don't know what your financial situation is, but let me make a suggestion. You try microdermabrasion, which is an actual mechanical procedure where you scour out the pores using a kind of a mini sandblaster.
Yeah, I kind of know what it. I have an idea what it is.
There's a lot of salons and day spas that have microdermabrasion apparatus, and I remember one case was a woman who was an employee of mine, and this is years and years ago. She had had she had pretty bad pustular acne. It wasn't deep cysts. It did eventually come to a head and drain, but she was, you know, quite badly disfigured by what she did have. And microdermabrasion worked great. It opened her pores, and the things were able to drain, and it kept them open. Other things that I would recommend to your sons, just basic physical cleansing issues. Never let sweat dry on your face. They need to have little wipes in their backpack on the minute that they sweat. After sports, you know, as they're walking off the field. Yeah, as they're walking off the field, they're whipping out one of these little alcohol, well, Clearasil or Seabreeze wipes or whatever, and just swabbing off their face. You'd never, because basically sebum plus dust and dirt equals a plugged pore. So when they sweat, they're going to open that pore. That's the moment to, you know, wash it out. Don't let that stuff harden in there. And then, you know, using a little bit of an abrasive like baking soda in a liquid soap and really scrubbing their face. I don't like the abrasive commercial abrasives because those are plastic particles, and ultimately they end up in the ocean, and plastic in the ocean, not no bueno. So what we really want to do is use something that's going to dissolve, and baking soda is a beautiful soft abrasive, and it works great for cleaning out pores. So more mechanical means like that. Dermatologists don't really push on the mechanical stuff as much as they should, because they have these drugs at their disposal, and you know we're in love with technology in our society, aren't we?
Right.
Okay, well, I hope that's been helpful.
It has. Thank you very much.
All right, thank you. Bye bye. Let's go now to Marguerite in Soquel. Hello, Marguerite.
Margaret.
Sorry.
Okay.
What can I do for you?
Well, I wondered if you know anything about Garcinia cambogia, which Dr. Oz talked about on his program for weight loss.
Right. We were talking about commercial self-interest and data, or I was alluding to that a few minutes ago. And really what I'll say about this is, it's an Indonesian plant. It's sometimes called the Malabar tamarind. It's just a little fruit. And you can do an extract of it called citric acid. And it's supposed to, there are you know, clinical studies, placebo, blah, 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 that do show some modest improvement in cholesterol and modest in appetite suppressant effect. It's not a miracle. If you really look at the studies, the effects are fairly modest. I think Dr. Oz is overly enthusiastic about products, and I don't know if there's a sponsorship arrangement going on there, but I would look for it because it feels like that. But that's, you know, not trying to smear him. I don't know the answer there, but you know, it's one of those follow the money things. If you want to use it, I mean, it's harmless.
No. Well, and so I do warn against using it if you're on statins, which I am.
I didn't know that. Let me see.
What I'm looking at said there was a clinical study, I guess, with that had included 50% of this acid, HCA, mm-hmm. plus other things. And within 3 hours, it causes a fatal degeneration of skeletal muscle called rhabdomyolysis.
And so this is a rare complication. I'll tell you what I think is going on there. This is a rare complication of statins, and it's idiosyncratic. Some individuals will get it. Statins are hard on muscle, and there's plenty of people who've been studied who are just out of the box, you know, test subjects, no special selection involved. And if you test their blood after they exercise for muscle breakdown, and you put them on a statin and then retest them, they break down more muscle with the same amount of activity. And when you, so their CPK levels in their bloodstream, which might rise, you know, a blip up a little bit when someone does a hard physical workout, blip up more. So that's a little spooky. And we know that statins have an effect on CoQ10, which is really important for mitochondria. And of course, when you're working out, you're pushing your mitochondria. So this may be part of the reason that we see a little bit of a rise in CPK. Rhabdomyolysis is the big version of that, where the muscles just break down, split open, and dump a whole bunch of myoglobin, which is the oxygen protein related to hemoglobin, into the bloodstream. This myoglobin gets filtered out by the kidneys, and the kidneys stop working because the filters are clogged. So it's a very rare, very dangerous thing, and it puts you on dialysis and can even kill you. There are a number of interactions that we know about. We know if we put someone on niacin and a statin, we'll get statistically more rhabdomyolysis. If we there are other drugs used for lowering cholesterol, gemfibrozil, or lopid, and if you mix those two with, if you mix that with a statin, you'll get more. And probably what's going on here is that we're affecting the metabolism of the statin and increasing the effective dose. So because we're interfering with the breakdown of the statin with this other agent, they're competing for breakdown, in other words, and so the line in the waiting room gets longer, and the waiting room being the bloodstream, it's as if you took twice as much statin.
Wow.
And so that obviously could be a herb-drug interaction as well as a drug-drug interaction. And so it's interesting. I have not seen that before. It's probably idiosyncratic in that individuals who have a poor enzyme for breaking down the statin, which is the 3A4 enzyme, that particular enzyme that's breaking down the statin would also be more likely to be breaking down the Garcinia cambogia, and therefore they step on each other's breakdown. That's plausible. If you've got a good strong enzyme, maybe it doesn't matter, but if you've got kind of a wimpy enzyme, it could matter a lot.
Oh, is there any way to tell?
Yeah, you can get yourself tested and look at the strength of your enzymes, but I think mixing things with statins needs to be done cautiously, and if there's a report that this is a problem, you know, you're not looking at a big enough benefit
okay.
to make it worth your while.
Take the risk. Okay.
You know, I know it's hard. I know it's hard to give up starch and sugar. I know it's a struggle. But you know, if you can manage to reduce your sugar and reduce your starch, you're going to and eat more vegetables. You're going to start to feel better, more energetic, and you'll go through a bad week of withdrawal. And then you will feel better, and it will be easier to lose weight, and you won't need to be, you know, looking for the magic pill.
Yeah. Okay.
You know, the magic pill is amphetamine. If you really want to lose weight and take a pill,
okay,
that's the magic pill. It works. Like, it works really well. But the problem is, of course, it's addictive and dangerous. So how much weight do you really want to lose that way?
Yeah. Right.
Right.
Okay. Well, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
That answers my question.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Just a quick little one to wrap up the hour. We need to push for insurance companies to cover genomic analysis of cancers, because we've gotten to the point now where we have drugs that target certain cancer genes. A recent study found that African-American women with breast cancer have a significantly higher prevalence of something called TP53. And this means that we have drugs that are targeted towards this type of cancer gene that we should be using in these women. African-American women have a much higher rate of death from breast cancer. We need to be targeting the cancer, of the genetics of the cancer. Well, we've come to an end of another hour, and I hope you've enjoyed it as much as I have. This is Dr. Dawn saying so long and stay healthy. Thank you.